Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, quick, what percentage of tenants in New York City housing court have lawyers? Answer, 10%. What percentage of landlords do? 98. On today's program, we'll talk about a coming city council plan to reduce that imbalance and take calls with your day in housing court stories. Also, what Chinese philosophy can teach us about spontaneity, the art of trying not to try, and what the University of Connecticut's 8% athlete graduation rate teaches us about who's an employee first and who is a student. But first, Bridgegate. Nearly half of the 344 pages in the report released by the governor's office yesterday are a rebuttal of Hoboken Mayor Dawn Zimmer's allegation that Governor Christie punished Hoboken with minimal Sandy aid because Mayor Zimmer didn't endorse a development project that the governor wanted. Basically, they spent half the report responding to this statement by Zimmer on CNN. She refers to the development project as the Rockefeller Plan.
The major question is, did they connect Sandy funding, Hoboken Sandy funding, to the Rockefeller project? The fact is, that is what they did. I'm coming forward. I'm sharing my story directly. I'm here talking to you. I'm sharing my journal. I'm offering to testify under oath. What are they doing? They're hiding behind spokespeople.
Mayor Dawn Zimmer on CNN a couple of months ago now. Let's talk to our Christie administration reporter, Matt Katz, and Metro reporter, Andrea Bernstein, about all kinds of things having to do with the report released yesterday. Hi, Matt. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ryan.
And let's start with this Dawn Zimmer piece. Remind us of what that project is, Matt, and tell us why half of this release being labeled as a Bridgegate report is really about development in San Diego in Hoboken.
This was a major redevelopment project in Hoboken, and the lobbyist for the Rockefeller Group it was David Sampson's law firm, Wolf & Sampson. And this is how this all connected to Bridgegate, is because David Sampson is the chairman of the Port Authority. And shortly after the Bridgegate allegations surfaced, Dawn Zimmer comes forward with these amazing allegations that high-level Christie officials, including the lieutenant governor, had tried to force her to approve this development project that David Sampson was lobbying for. And if she didn't approve it, they were going to take away her Sandy money. This was a big deal at the time, but it sort of subsided in the public's consciousness. Dawn Zimmer stopped speaking to reporters about it. And Bridgegate was what people were really most intrigued by, interested in. That's what the legislative hearings were about. But half of this report goes through a detailed step-by-step destruction of Zimmer and her argument. This is what came out yesterday. It was fascinating reading.
And Brian, I just would add to that, I think what is very fascinating about this report is that it really does read like a statement for the defense. It not so much, we interviewed all of these people and this is what they told us and here's the evidence, but sort of, presenting pictures of Mayor Zimmer at a press conference saying, does she look like somebody who had just been threatened? I mean, this is an argument you would make to a jury.
In fact, hold that thought for a second, because I want to play a clip of the attorney who led this Christie report, Randy Mastro, speaking on Fox 5 this morning about this photograph that they released with the report of Mayor Zimmer yawning after a meeting that they say is evidence that no one threatened her with political retribution.
Photographs showing her smiling, laughing, yawning when she was supposedly being threatened. She says that she was pulled aside at an event by the lieutenant governor, set up to be pulled aside to be delivered a message, and it turns out she actually asked the lieutenant governor for that private meeting. The hard evidence belies her claims, and at the end of the day, her subjective perceptions do not match objective reality.
Randy Mastro on Channel 5 this morning. So what's that photograph, Andrea?
Right. Well, it's a photograph from a video of a press event or an event with Mayor Zimmer and Christie administration officials about Hoboken 8 issues. But, I mean, I don't know what somebody looks like who's just been threatened. You know, I don't know. But I
and
think,
her
you
claim
know,
is that right. she was threatened in a private meeting
right.
by a Christie official
right. a,
with losing Sandy 8 if she didn't endorse a particular development
right,
project.
Right, in a ShopRite parking lot. But I think, you know, yesterday at the press conference with Mastro, we kept saying to him, well, where's the evidence? Where's the transcript? Where's the witness list? And these things were not given to us. And I would just remind the listeners that Mayor Zimmer was not interviewed. The lobbyist for Wolf Sampson, Lori Grifa, wasn't interviewed. David Sampson wasn't interviewed. And I would love to see the interview with the lieutenant governor. Nobody for this report was interviewed under oath. One time when Randy Mastro was deputy mayor a long, long time ago, he advised me to treat such interviews with skepticism on a totally unrelated matter. But be that as it may, we just heard Mayor Zimmer saying, I would testify under oath. So I think that, you know, this report just leaves us with many more questions than answers.
And Matt, the report says the governor did not know that the Rockefeller Project in Hoboken was represented by Sampson's law firm. Did they offer any evidence for him not knowing?
No, I didn't see any. But then again, they gave us tens of thousands of pages of maybe 10,000 approximately pages of backup documents.
You haven't read them all yet?
You know, Andrew and I did pull an all-nighter, but we have been unable to get through it all yet.
Did they offer any evidence for why he might otherwise be so concerned?
No. They did not. I mean, there's very little kind of direct quotes from the governor at all in this report. I mean, in terms of the Zimmer thing, they talked to somebody who was sitting near her at this public event where she says she was threatened. They talked to a Democratic mayor from Belmar, and he says he didn't hear the threat. And that's what they coupled with these photographs. It was a series of photographs of her yawning and smiling, which is not apparently what you do when you're threatened, according to the report.
Andrea, to your point, I wonder if we have any attorneys listening right now who've been paying attention to the news on this over the last day since the report was released, who have an opinion about whether this is a defense attorney's document or a legitimate state investigation. And remember, this was funded with about $1 million of taxpayers' money. This is not Christie's personal lawyer on behalf of the governor's office. He hired attorney Randy Mastro to conduct this internal report on Bridgegate and the Hoboken allegations and come up with a report. Everything we've been reporting on seems to make it sound, I think it's fair to say to Andrea and to Matt and to me, like this is a defense attorney's report with respect to Governor Christie, not kind of a balanced, well, let's look at all the evidence and where it leads.
Right. And I think that we saw that, I think, most clearly in the treatment of one of the most potentially damaging new pieces of evidence in this report, which was about the conversation that David Wildstein had with Governor Christie on 9/11. And they used the phrase, does not recall. Christie does not recall Mr. Wildstein discussing any traffic. And even if he did, they say he wouldn't have noticed it. So if Mr. Wildstein has evidence, as his lawyer has alleged, for example, if he was secretly taping the conversation, they're laying the groundwork to say, well, Christie doesn't remember that. Why would he remember it? Traffic is something that's discussed all the time. But they also noted in the report, and this wasn't a very long I would say it was less than a page, the description of the 9/11 events. But they also noted that there were 4,000 people there. There were so many people there talking to the governor. How could he possibly remember what they didn't answer? And I asked this to Mr. Mastro in a follow-up question saying, well, who did you interview of the people there other than the governor? I mean, the governor obviously didn't go to Ground Zero alone. Who else was with him? Did they interview those people? What were the other witnesses? One of the witnesses was Bill Baroni, who they didn't interview. One of them was Mr. Sampson, who they didn't interview. And one of them was Mr. Wildstein. So, again, there's many, many questions that I think we still have about these events.
All right. And let's move back from Hoboken to Bridgegate itself. And here's Governor Christie on ABC last night with Diane Sawyer.
This report says that I had no knowledge of it before it happened, nor did I authorize it or have anything to do with it. And that's the truth.
But does it make you feel clueless? Does it make you feel like, what was wrong with me?
Not clueless, but it certainly makes me feel taken advantage of. And also, more importantly, you know, I feel like I let people down.
Matt, how do you connect the governor's statement there with the report in the way it was released?
They are they're trying to create the sense that there was this tight-knit conspiracy separate from the governor's office. Now, let's back up a second and talk about who wrote this report. Written by Randy Mastro, Governor Mayor Giuliani's former deputy mayor. Giuliani's been Governor Christie's top defender since this thing happened. One of Mastro's assistants is Deborah Wong Yang. She was at the press conference yesterday. She's a former U.S. attorney who has vacationed with the Christies. She gave money to his inaugural party. Her daughter interned in his office. These are people that are clearly aligned with the governor. So in their report, they're making the case that this is a small, tight-knit conspiracy, very separate from the governor and his inner sanctum.
Yeah.
So toward that end, they demonize and castigate two specific people.
Andrew? Yeah, I was just gonna jump in. Matt and I have been talking about this way for the last 24 hours. I mean, I think that one of the things that's so amazing about that Diane Sawyer comment is when she sort of said to him, "Well, did you learn anything and did you do anything wrong?" He said, "Well, the thing I did wrong was I trusted people too much." And I think one of the kind of amazing things about this report. And, you know, I've had a lot of experience with prosecutors. One time, a very long time ago, I worked for a prosecutor. Prosecutors like to find wrongdoing if they're doing a serious report. They like to find that you, Brian Lehrer, submitted a receipt for 99 cents, not 97 cents, which is what the receipt says.
So, unless you're the defense attorney. And Randy Mastro has a career in that, too. He represents Chevron in this huge environmental pollution case having to do with the rainforest in Ecuador.
Absolutely. But he made a point of saying, I think three times during the press conference, that six former federal prosecutors had worked on this. But what they found was nobody did anything wrong other than the four people who have resigned from the Christie administration. So, and the governor's sort of comments feed into that. There was no sense of self-reflection. Maybe we should have had more controls. Maybe we were sending the wrong signals. Maybe we should have been supervising our staff more closely. Maybe we should have been more careful who we appointed to senior powerful positions. Pretty much none of that. Everyone was exonerated, including some of the people that others have concluded, including the governor previously, Bill Baroni and Bill Stepien, might have done something wrong. So even those two, there was a path to rehabilitation. As you got closer to Governor Christie, the idea was there was less wrongdoing.
So they were completely throwing David Wildstein and Bridget Ann Kelly under the bus and trying to make it all about these two rogues who were Christie appointees doing these things without the knowledge or approval of the governor and with only marginal involvement by these other people close to the governor who were in that email chain.
Right. And they described Wildstein as crazy, and they made sure that we knew, it was very high up on the report, that Bridget Ann Kelly had a sexual relationship with Bill Stepien, and that he had broken it off and that they weren't speaking to each other.
Stepien being the campaign manager for Christie during the reelection last year. And there's pushback from people close to Bridget Ann Kelly saying that whole thing is sexist, or the way it's being spun is sexist.
Right. That she's
sexist in what way? And what do you think about that?
That she's being slut-shamed. In other words, that she's being discredited because of her relationships and her behavior. You know, she is... You know, the report also could have presented her as a Catholic school trained devout Catholic mother of four. I mean, you know, there are other ways that it could have described her, and that certainly gives you a different image. She's the only one whose sexual habits or relationships were discussed. I mean, we don't know who Bill Baroni was seeing. We don't know who David Wildstein was seeing, or any of the other figures, you know, who they might have had relationships
except
was not
Stepien,
raised.
Except the campaign manager who she was with and who basically also got fired by Christie as a result of Bridgegate.
Right. And I asked Randy Mastro about this yesterday. I asked him after his press conference why that fact was relevant regarding her. And his argument was, well, because it suggests that they weren't speaking, therefore there was no conspiracy. That's a paraphrase. I don't have his exact response. But I said, but he also argued that she lied to everybody and hid it from everybody, which is why no one on the governor's staff knew that she had gone to such great lengths. So if she was lying to everybody and not speaking, it's not entirely clear to me why evidence of her relationships is germane. Presumably she could have lied to him too.
About Bridgegate?
And nobody also, they didn't talk to Kelly or Stepien. So if she was lying about things, then how do we know these now intimate details of their personal life? We now know that they got together in May and broke up, and he dumped her in early August. Why and how we know this information is unclear. And the other justification he uses in bringing this up is, this is the quote from the report, events in Kelly's personal life may have had some bearing on her subjective motivations and state of mind. And that's a line that is particularly galling to some people, that somehow this woman was emotional over this relationship and her state of mind was affected.
Caused her to order this crazy, wacky lane closure?
Right, apparently. I mean, again, it's sort of like, what does somebody who's been threatened look like? What is somebody who's broken up in a consensual adult relationship at the time of their relationship? They were both single. They weren't working together. You know, what does somebody like that act like? I don't know that there is a pattern. I mean, there's all kinds of people in that situation. Not all of them are closing the lanes on the George Washington Bridge.
I think it was Shakespeare who said, fake traffic studies know no fury like a woman scorned.
Yeah, exactly. No, but, you know, and then, but the clearly what this report is laying the groundwork for is, if she does come forward with evidence that other people in the governor's office knew, or even the governor himself, they have these, she's this sort of untrustworthy, scorned lover. What do you expect her to say? Defense all teed up.
Listeners, any questions about the 344-page Bridgegate report from the governor's office to our two, what should we call you, parsers, more than perusers, parsers of the document at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, including any lawyers listening right now, to weigh in on whether, with everything that you've heard here and however much you've consumed in other media about this report, or maybe even read it yourself. And by the way, we have the full report on our site. If you want to go through parts of this or all of this, you want to pull your own all-nighter tonight, getting really intimately familiar with the Mastro report on Bridgegate, you can at WNYC.org click on Brian Lehr Show. Attorneys, does this sound like the 9/11 Commission report, the federal report on how the financial crisis happened, which threw analysis and blame in complex ways in all directions? Or does this sound like a defense attorney's document at taxpayer expense? 212-433-9692. Robert in Manhattanville, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, Brian. I'm an attorney and a litigator. And I've done work on both sides of the ledger in business fraud matters. And this, the first thing that struck me about this report is that it's like James St. Clair's report during the Watergate process. He represented President Nixon in his presidential capacity. The president, of course, lied to him, didn't tell him about the tapes, and that's important. Evidence that here for this report, clearly, including interviews and things like that, has not been conducted. And therefore, you can only conclude about this report that it is, in effect, a defense lawyer's document. And therefore, it is somewhat of a whitewash. You cannot do a complete investigation in an objective way, a la the 9/11 Commission, which I think was a fairly good report, unless you have real genuine access, objectively, to, in effect, the whole range of things. And clearly here, as your parses were talking about, there's a whole range of witnesses, documents that they don't have. And so it's a speculative report. Quite frankly, I think relatively speaking, it's worthless. You know, to some extent, one of the questions, and Andrea may be able to answer this, is who was Randy Mastro and Gibson Dunn representing? Were they representing the office of the governor? Were they representing Chris Christie in his official capacity, I think so, hence, you know, he's getting paid $1 million of taxpayers' money, or were they in any way representing Chris Christie in a personal capacity?
A good technical lawyer's question.
I think that the answer is so complicated. Mr. Master went to pains to say we are representing the office of the governor, and that he just met Chris Christie the day that he started to do this work. He didn't say that one of the other prosecutors or one of the other lawyers working on this was friends with Christie and had vacationed with him. But they are also, in addition to doing this report, which they say exonerates him, they are also representing him in the legislative and the other inquiries. So they sort of have this dual role. And, you know, I think that one of the things that's very complicated and hard to answer in this Christie circle is who is acting in what role? And, you know, this, of course, brings us back to Mr. David Sampson, the chair of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, who was not interviewed, whose name is all over the Bridgegate documents that were submitted to the legislature, who had many, many phone calls with many of the main actors during this whole period, and is an active Christie appointee. And the fact that he wasn't interviewed is curious. But when Master was asked, he said, well, Wolf Sampson didn't participate. That would be Mr. Sampson's private law firm, not saying, you know, this is the man who was the boss of all of these people who did this.
Let's take a call from a professional with a different kind of expertise. This ought to be interesting. This is a psychiatrist, I think, calling in on the Dawn Zimmer piece. Ken in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ken.
Hi. You know, when they say yawning and smiling are signs that she wasn't stressed, it, to me, you know, as a psychiatrist, I look for little things and then extrapolate. Often people do some small thing in their life and that's sort of a reflection of a major issue. And for them to be saying yawning in particular and then also smiling means she wasn't stressed, to me, points out the bogusness of the entire report and how it's clearly a defense spin. Because yawning usually occurs when we're tired, but yawning is a clear sign of anxiety and stress also. And so for them to say it means that she's relaxed, it could certainly be just the opposite. I didn't really see the photo, but also a smile. I mean, we all know, you don't have to be an expert to know that sometimes when people are upset or stressed, they smile. Often, if you're right next to them, you can see that the smile is sort of forced, but they're trying to show the other person that they're not upset, or they're trying to overcome a feeling of stress inside them.
Did Freud write about yawns?
I don't know.
Just curious. Ken, thank you very much. Al in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Al.
Howdy. I'm trying to get you off a speakerphone.
That would be a good thing.
All right. Now you're off. I think the real issue is, what does this say about Christie as a presidential candidate? And if you go back to his Alan Alda press conference of January.
Alan Alda?
When he lied. Yeah, it was based on West Wing, more or less, if you compare it to TV.
It was so, what?
You know, he had a 2.5-hour press conference in January. You remember that?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Alan Alda, why?
At that conference.
Because of West Wing.
Oh, right? So, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I thought that was common knowledge. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Any rate, in his 2-hour press conference, he insisted that you fire anyone who lies to you. And in that same press conference, he told different stories of his staff meeting at the start and end of the press conference, implying that one of the two stories is a lie, and he was lying to the people of New Jersey at the time he said you have to fire liars. He also argued at that press conference that because he could not keep track of what was happening in New Jersey, which is incompetence in a governor, he has to be deemed innocent. And he's totally flubbing just about everything he's doing to defend his reputation and standing as a presidential candidate.
Al, thank you. I don't think we can conclude that the governor lied. We don't know that, right? It was interesting how he parsed. In fact, I wonder if we can pull up.
No, Brian, the governor has been exonerated.
I forgot. can we pull up that Christie clip that we played a minute ago from Diane Sawyer? There's something about the language in this. that I think is worthy of drilling down on just a little bit. Let's see if that clip is still available. All right. Here's Christie on ABC. And listen very carefully to what he says here he did not know. And then we're going to talk about something that he leaves out.
This report says that I had no knowledge of it before it happened, and nor did I authorize it and or have anything to do with it. And that's the truth.
But does it make you feel clueless? Does it make you feel like, what was wrong with me?
Not clueless, but it certainly makes me feel taken advantage of. And also, more importantly, yeah, I feel like I let people down.
Matt, no prior knowledge, didn't order it, didn't have anything to do with it. What he didn't say there, which I think is new, is that he didn't have any knowledge of the lane closures while they were going on. He previously has said he did not have any knowledge of the lane closures while they were going on. But now I think there's evidence that he was told on September 11th of all days, which was one of the days of the lane closures in the fall. Is that in the report?
Well, he's never denied that he didn't know that there was traffic, right? So there's like three things about the what did he know, when, and how. So then there are three different what's. It's there was traffic. The traffic was caused by a crazy lane closure scheme, and there was a cover-up. So did he know of any of those three things? He's saying he didn't know about the cover-up, and he didn't know that the lanes were closed due to some crazy
the crazy David Wildstein and the scorned Bridget Ann Kelly.
The scorned lover, right. But he has never said he didn't know about the traffic. He said, you know, I'm in the car, I listen to the radio. I probably knew that there was traffic that day. I might have known there was traffic that day. He's not denied that piece. So okay. I think that is how he's parsing this. But, you know, he talked for 2 hours, and there is definitely things to pick apart there. And he's talking again this afternoon at 2:30.
Is he going to go all Alan Alda on us again?
I hope so. I got a lot of questions.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, what a couple of things about the traffic issue is that one of the things that the report really elided yesterday was it wasn't just that there was bad traffic. There's bad traffic all the time. We live in the New York City metropolitan area. It's that there were dangerous conditions created and that there were officials, including the mayor of Fort Lee, the police chief of Fort Lee, that were saying, we can't get through, EMT, people are stuck, school children are stuck, this is dangerous, and it's a threat to public safety. And quite a few people said that. The report sort of didn't address that issue, But I think that the question about the presidential aspirations is really, really important because that is really what the Diane Sawyer interview was about. And if in case you missed that point, Christie mentioned how much he's loved in Iowa. But he's going this weekend to Nevada, to Las Vegas, to meet with potential donors to his campaign. And I think that it was very important to him to sort of be able to say to the donor community, I'm cleared, so that he can raise a lot of money. And if sometime, a year from now, the prosecutor in New Jersey, best case for Christie, issues some kind of report, worst case, some kind of indictments. But Christie can say, no, there already was a report. This is old news. It wasn't me. And it's sort of the Scott Walker defense. Scott Walker had some kind of corruption scandal in his past. And that's what he's saying. It's old news. So I think that's sort of the what is going on here.
And we're almost out of time, but I did want to end on this context anyway, because the two of you did this great back and forth morning edition piece that folks, you can still listen to on our website at WNYC.org. The premise of which was basically, if you can overlook the pesky questions of what happened and why with the George Washington Bridge lane closures, you can appreciate this 344-page report as a case study in how a possible presidential candidate reacts to a crisis. So our guests, by the way, as we finish up, are WNYC's own professors of Bridgegateology, Professors Bernstein and Katz, Christie administration reporter Matt Katz, and our senior editor for politics and policy and doctor of all things Port Authority and Port Authority Studies, Andrea Bernstein. What didn't we talk about so far that is included in that instructive case study of how a potential presidential candidate reacts to a crisis?
Well, go ahead, Matt.
I think we hit a lot of them. There was the final step in our 6-point list of what crisis management looks like was to propose reforms. So today, there were reforms proposed in the report that was released yesterday about turning the Port Authority around, changing the management structure there, changing the management structure of the governor's office, and getting rid of the office where Bridget Kelly worked and merging it with another office and hiring an ethics officer. And that could be all well and good, and maybe that's what Christie's going to talk about today and propose. However, the report doesn't say there's any systemic issues. So the report sort of makes it out to seem like this happened because of an isolated incident, and yet they're proposing these big reforms. Why? Because that's what people want to hear after a scandal. That's what you do in a crisis situation. You manage it by proposing reforms at the end and moving forward. And I think that's the final piece of this.
And I would just add, Brian, that it's really, I mean, as we've been talking about for the last half hour or so, it's really important to ask the right questions. And this report asks and answers a set of questions, but it doesn't answer a whole other set of questions. For example, what did Sampson know? What kind of environment was created by Christie? Why did Bridget Ann Kelly and David Wildstein think the governor would be pleased by this behavior? So all of these things haven't asked, and I would just advise people going forward, let's not say, did Christie know there was traffic, but who else in his administration knew that there was some kind of what Pat Foy has called aberrant situation at the George Washington Bridge that second week of September?
And, you know, Diane Sawyer did ask about whether the governor specifically knew that the traffic problem was going on as the traffic problem was going on. Let's listen to a little bit of that from last night.
David Wildstein has said that at a 9/11 event, he talked to you about traffic. It's a little ambiguous exactly what. Did he?
Yeah, I don't have any recollection of that, Diane. David was one of hundreds of people that I spoke to that day. We stood around and spoke briefly that day. I don't have any recollection of him saying anything, but I'll tell you this. I'll tell you what he didn't say. He didn't say, hey, by the way, Governor, I'm closing down some lanes on the George Washington Bridge to stick it to the mayor. Is that okay? That I'd remember.
Wait a minute. Amy in Hoboken is a lawyer. Amy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Have you ever had a client who you instructed to say, I don't recall? Like the
well,
governor just
classic.
Said that.
That's pretty classic defense attorney practice. I work on the other side, and we, you know, do a lot to try to work around that I don't recall. I mean, that's a classic evasive technique. What I was calling in to say, and I mentioned to your screener about mm-hmm. this, was how, if you look at the treatment of Dawn Zimmer and Bridget Ann Kelly as the two main women, you know, that the governor's office has attacked in this mm-hmm. report, both of them are treated in stereotypic, you know, female hysterical ways, talking about mannerisms, talking about, you know, if they're smiling, talking about their appearance, talking about their sexual relations, where, and I know your guest mentioned this earlier, we don't know what Bill Baroni is doing in his bedroom. We didn't talk about his mannerisms when he was before the legislative committee. It seems as if they're using this, the, you know, classic, you know, undermine women by calling out, you know, all their physical and you know, personality traits, which is, again, a way to just deflect from the fact that these women have, you know, there are other components to them besides just what they look like and how they act. I mean, it's just really upsetting as a female in New Jersey that the governor's office is just singling them out in this way.
Amy, thank you. Andrew Bernstein, a final word.
Yeah, I think, well, that's the question, that the biggest question is, if these people were crazy and unstable, why were they entrusted with so much power in the state of New Jersey?
Christie administration reporter Matt Katz, and senior editor for Politics and Policy, and doctor of Port Authority Studies, Andrea Bernstein. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt, I guess you're going to be at the 2:30 news conference. We'll see if Christie goes from Alan Alda on West Wing to Alan Alda on MASH in some way.
I'll be there, man.
And whatever else happens, so we'll hear your reports later on. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thanks.